The previous text, the previous chapters of Isaiah, we've been dealing with warnings and woes in the midst of promises. And we acknowledge that last week, with chapter 28, we had kind of turned a page. And we had moved from Isaiah's prophecies about a time far in the future to how those promises would relate to the here and now. Not for us, of course, but for his original audience, the Jews around him. And you'll see in chapter 9 that it continues that pattern. It does this by referencing a very specific historical event, the siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib. And you may recognize some similarities between chapter 28 and 29. They deal with basically the same subject and the same events that are going to take place. But there's one major difference between them. Chapter 28 is the message that's given to the people before the fall of Samaria. And chapter 29, what we've read this morning, is basically the same message for the same people, but it's given after the fall. That is, it's given after the world, and specifically Israel, has seen just how mighty the Assyrians are. It's given after the display of their military power. It's given at a time where the Israelites could say with relative certainty, Jerusalem is going to fall. At this moment in Israel's history, even King Hezekiah is becoming a bit weak in the knees. He is conflicted. He is worried. And that temptation that we've talked about before, for Israel to look to Egypt for their salvation, that temptation is now stronger than it has ever been. You see, their city is surrounded. The armies of the Assyrians have begun their siege, and it matters not which direction you look from the gates. All you will see is the mighty, mighty army. Now, Isaiah will recount the specific historical events that take place here in a couple of chapters, 36 and 37. He speaks very specifically about what happens in this siege. But in this chapter, he's going to speak about those same events, but he's going to do it in more general terms. Because what he wants to do, where his interest is the principles that are at work here, the ideas that we should take away from the events, and specifically the ideas that Israel should have taken away even as the events were occurring. It was Winston Churchill who once said, "All of history has a current application." Isaiah's question, his concern would be, what are we learning? What are we learning from the events that have taken place in the past? What are we learning from the events that are taking place around us? How are we applying the things that God has said, the things that God has shown, to the way we interpret reality? Isaiah wants to know what Israel is learning, or perhaps what they're not learning from what's happening all around them. And you know, it's interesting to me how often I hear people say, and I say myself, that we want God to speak to us. We want God to show us what He's doing. We want God to teach us about what to expect. And yet I wonder when He does, when He speaks through history, when He speaks through His working in the world, are we even paying attention? Isaiah will teach the people an important lesson from the events taking place around them. And he will teach them a lesson about the sovereignty of God. He begins with a word picture, one that may not be familiar to us. It's a title I don't think we've heard used for Israel before, and it's the title of Ariel. And you may have in your Bible translation, in your study notes at the bottom, some options there for what this word could mean. But let me shortcut all that and tell you that in this context, it means altar hearth. We know what a hearth is. It conveys an image of gathering around a place of warmth in your home. That expression of hearth and home refers to a place where we're comfortable, a place where you're made warm by the fire in the fireplace. It conjures up that image of walking into the house on a cold and wet winter day and seeing that someone has a roaring fire going in the fireplace, and that feeling, that sensation we all get of wanting to get nearer to that and to get warm and to get dry and to be comfortable and in some ways to be secure and happy around that fire. This name of Ariel refers to the ever-burning fire of God, which is the visible representation of God's presence among the people of Israel. And Isaiah uses this title here because he wants to draw out the two kinds of consequences that exist when you have the presence of God in your midst. One Old Testament scholar says it this way, that it is both a privilege and a peril to live with the fire of God. It is a danger to sinners, but it is also the means of their salvation. The fire of God is a place of holy wrath and a place of divine preservation. That Ariel, those people in the presence of God, see God as a hearth, as a place of warmth, as a place of protection, because they're people of faith. But that same fire, that same hearth is an altar of burning wrath for those who do not believe. In some senses, it's appropriate to say that coming into the presence of God is a dangerous endeavor, because it will reveal you as being in one or the other of these categories: a person of faith who finds comfort and warmth in God's presence, or a person who sees only his burning wrath against sin. Isaiah wants them to take this imagery, this idea of the presence of God among them, and consider what that means for their current historical situation. And their circumstances are quite the roller coaster. You see, beginning in verses 3 and 4, that they are in a time of trouble. The siege has begun. The encampment is all around them, and the siege works are being built. They're in a place of great humility and a place of fear. The walls are pressing in on them. There seems to be no means of escape, nowhere to turn from the circumstances that have befallen them. And it seems there is no one in whom they could place their trust. But then, in an instant, everything changes. Did you notice, beginning in verse 5, it said, "The multitude of your foreign foes shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the ruthless like passing chaff." Now here's what happens. The army that has surrounded the city, the army that has built the siege works, the army that is prepared to attack the city and to bring an end to Jerusalem as we know it, packs up their things and walks away. They don't do this because of some military threat. They don't do this because of some cataclysmic event. They just pick up their things and walk away. In fact, as you read some of these verses, you get the impression that they don't even know why they're walking away. They just do. This is what happened. It looked as if Israel, or as Jerusalem, was certainly to be destroyed, and then the army just turned and went away. In an instant, the trouble was gone. They vanished as if they were nothing. And why did this happen? Well, it tells you in verse 6, it happens because the Lord of hosts visits his people. It doesn't happen because of something Israel does. It doesn't happen because of something their allies do. It happens because the Lord of hosts makes it so. And that's the key here. That's what Isaiah wants the people to see. This God who is among us, this burning fire who is with us, He can do this. And He will do this. All of our circumstances are in His control. He is sovereign. And when things like this happen, O Israel, don't you see that God is at work? We could make the same application to our own lives, couldn't we? Have we not seen God act in mighty ways? God will again act in mighty ways in the future. Things happen in our lives for which there are no other explanation. And we are sure to know that this is the work of a sovereign God. Israel is surrounded by besieging armies. Why? Because of the sovereign plan of God. And then those armies just pick up and walk away. Why? Because of the sovereign plan of God. And this wasn't the only time something like this would happen in Israel's history. They would have lots of these providential near misses. You might remember one moment they were standing next to a giant sea with an army chasing from behind, and something happened. God does this all the time. He makes a way where there seems to be no way. In the Civil War, there was a Union officer from Maine. He was at the Battle of Gettysburg, a colonel named Chamberlain. And he, in that one battle at Gettysburg, had three providential near misses, three moments where he should have been dead. And yet he wasn't. He had one moment where he was shot in the leg, but instead of the bullet going into his thigh, it hit his scabbard where he would keep his sword. A scabbard is about this thick. And that's where the bullet hit, and it just bruised his leg instead of going all the way through. He had another moment where, as he's going through the woods, he comes face to face with a Confederate officer who has a revolver pointed at his face, inches away. And the officer pulls the trigger and hears click, click, because there's no more rounds. He wouldn't find out about a third one until long after the war. He gets a letter from a marksman, or what we call a sniper, from Alabama, who wrote him this letter and said, I just wanted you to know that I was very good at my job, and I was not weak in the knees. I killed many men before I encountered you, and many men after I encountered you. But at the Battle of Gettysburg, I had you dead in my sights, and something would not let me pull the trigger. Three of these providential misses in one battle, and you think, because we think through the eyes of faith, that when you hear stories like this, they're a reflection of God's sovereignty, and they cause us to marvel at the sovereignty of God. But it's not that way for everyone. It was not that way for Chamberlain, and in Isaiah's case, it was not that way for Israel. And that's why Isaiah explains to them and shows them the horrors and the danger of spiritual blindness. I found a great definition this week for spiritual blindness. It's those who show no desire to be affected by Scripture, by inward guilt, or by a threatened sense of eternal doom. No desire to be affected by those things. And this is the condition of those who look at what is happening in history and who attribute none of it to God. It's the condition of those who do not accept the message of Isaiah or the message of God with faith. It's the condition that Jesus described. It's recorded in Mark chapter 8. He says, "Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And ears, do you not hear?" It's a very real condition, spiritual blindness. But for our purposes, as we look for a current application, I think what we would want to know most is, how does someone get this way? How does one become spiritually blind? And Isaiah answers that question for the people. He says first in verse 9 very clearly that this is an act of man. He says, "Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind." This is self-chosen. As we determine not to acknowledge God, not to acknowledge who He is, not to acknowledge what He has done. This is having those moments like Chamberlain in our lives and yet refusing to see with the eyes of faith what God is at work doing. This could happen with Israel. You think about this siege that takes place. And again, we look through the eyes of faith, and so we say that it's obvious that God has done this. An army that's gathered around us, there's nothing to stop them from destroying us, and they simply walk away. The eyes of faith say, clearly, this is the work of God. But one commentary pointed out, it is by no means certain that all Jerusalem would see it that way. The politicians in Israel would have seen this retreat as the vindication of their treaty with Egypt, while others in Israel would simply shrug their shoulders and take it as a happy chance. You know those people. Perhaps we've been those people, where these amazing acts of God take place and their response is, well, didn't that luck out? No, that's blindness. The eyes of faith see that God is always at work. This action, this choice of blinding yourself, is so destructive that it can actually be turned from a choice into a permanent condition. Thus, the commentary I referenced concluded this way: willful blindness to the things of God decreases the chances of ever thinking clearly or finding the right way again. That leads to the other thing Isaiah teaches about spiritual blindness, and that is that this is an act of God. Look at verse 10. For the Lord has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes, the prophets, and covered your heads, the seers. This permanent condition of unchangeable blindness is God's judgment on those who have chosen to disregard Him. He solidifies them in their choice, and He prevents them with their faithless thinking from ever seeing clearly again. That's what it refers to in verse 10 there, with deep sleep. And then He withdraws from them the very things that would point them to the truth. He takes away the prophets. He takes away the seers. We know well the story of Pharaoh and the idea in that text that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But if you read the text carefully, you see Pharaoh hardened his heart long before God ever did. But once God had, there was no turning back. He had made His choice. And let me be clear. This is not about understanding what God is doing. This is not about liking what God is doing. This is a question of how or why versus what. We may not understand how God is working. We may not understand why He is doing what He is doing. That's not what we're called to do. What we're called to do is simply to acknowledge that He is at work and to trust that because He is the one who is at work, the outcome of His work is good. Isaiah tells us that the results of this spiritual blindness are identifiable. When this exists in the lives of people, it's always manifested in the same ways. The first is false worship and graceless hypocrisy. Look, beginning in verse 13, because this people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment taught by men. Therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people. The people of spiritual blindness go through the motions of worship. They do what they're told to do, not because they believe it, but because they've been told to do it. Further, they create their own laws while having no concern for what God has actually said. This is made manifest in the New Testament, in the Pharisees, the scribes, and religious rulers. And when God looks at their worship, what He sees, as rigorous as their worship is, as in one sense law-abiding as their worship is, what God sees when He looks at their worship is that it is all about them and not about Him. It's about what they've said and not about what He has said. There's a wonderful line about this from an Old Testament scholar named Alec Moyer. He says, worship is not worship unless it is based on and responds to what God has said. What God has said. It's not worship if it's based on and a response to what man has said. Or at least it's not worship of God. And that's what God sees when He looks at these faithless people. They've made worship man-centered. They've made the Christian life man-centered by creating these laws and piling heavy burdens on the backs of others. And when you make worship man-centered, when you make life man-centered, what you inevitably do is to make it me-centered. Because if we are going to live by and worship by the words of man, well, who's better to follow than mine? And each one of you would say likewise. And so what God sees is this selfish heart that cannot love God and cannot love neighbor rightly. And that's why I called it graceless. We set up the rules. We set the priorities. We judge the actions and hearts of others. And we judge them by what standard? Not God's, but our own. This leads the pastor, Derek Thomas, to conclude that it is sadly possible to have a heart that desires orthodoxy, but at the same time is closed to God's grace. This is why, and it is sad, as Dr. Thomas says, you can find many people in the church, many people in Reformed churches, who know the doctrines well, who know the words of faith backward and forward, and yet they are unable and unwilling to apply them with the least measure of grace to the very people God has called them to love. And Isaiah tells us that God will judge this. We're not told how, but in verse 14, we're told that He will judge this. And that use of the word wonderful is not the good kind. That's not the good kind of wonderful that He'll do something happy for them. It's the kind of wonderful that you will be full of wonder and awe when you see what He does to these people. Another effect of this spiritual blindness is self-delusion. Isaiah talks in verses 15 and 16 about those who hide deep from the Lord their counsel, who say, "Who sees us and who knows us?" They think they can ignore God, or they think they can fool God. They think their plans matter and His plans don't, that their wisdom is great and His is optional, that God may be there, but He's just no big deal. This is the mindset of the spiritually blind. They think they're going to win. They think that all of the world, and at the end of the world, things will have been played by their rules, and that they're going to win. And this is why you encounter in this world and in the church now people who even for a time appear to have one. But this is the mindset of the spiritually blind. And their understanding of reality, Isaiah says, is upside down. They've got it all backwards. They look at the potter and think that he's the clay. And they look at themselves and think that they're going to win. The reality is that's what God is going to do in His judgment. He's going to turn the world upside down, and He's going to do it for all to see. That's how Isaiah concludes this passage. Beginning in verse 17, he gives, I'm not quite sure how to explain his tone here. It's not at all threatening. It's very matter of fact. His voice is not raised. He's not trying to intimidate. He's simply stating this is the reality of the thing. One man paraphrased it by saying, people can deny God His proper place if they want to, but He's still the Lord. He will do what He will on earth and in heaven, and He needs no permission to do so. That's how Isaiah concludes, is that what the world needs is to be turned upside down, not in the way these faithless men have done it, but in the way God will do it. The world as it is full of sin. The world as it is filled with the effects of the fall and the curse, and it needs to be made right. And that's what God will do. Isaiah refers in verse 22 to Abraham and Jacob. He does this because these are significant characters in the history of Israel. These names would have great meaning to his audience. And he uses it first as a bit of a negative, where he says that Jacob would be ashamed of the faithlessness of the people of Israel right now. We have a southern equivalent of this. This is when you've been told by a parent or an aunt or an uncle that your grandmother would be rolling in her grave if she could see what you had done now. That's what Isaiah is saying, is that Jacob would be rolling in his grave if he saw the faithlessness of you people. But he puts it in a positive way. He says, when God is done with you, Jacob shall no more be ashamed. And he connects that to Abraham as if to say, don't you believe that the same God who redeemed Abraham, the same God who always came through for Abraham and who persevered him unto the end, don't you believe the same God will do that for you? This world needs to be turned upside down, but you can be certain that God is going to do it. How? Well, make no mistake, this text is about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in a way, that's how God's going to do it. But it's not by destroying the city of Jerusalem. It's by destroying and bringing to an end the spiritual blindness that had laid siege to this city and this people. In verse 18, he will give hearing and sight. That means there's going to be real faith among the people. In verses 19 and 21, you see that he's going to institute justice in this world, real justice, the kind that our spirits long for now, the kind that will make the meek joyful, that will cause the poor to exult, the kind that will destroy the ruthless and will cut off all false witnesses. And you see at the end of this chapter that the result of this, that God would show himself to his people, is that they will know him and they will worship him in love. They will truly worship him because of their teachable hearts, because they've been transformed inwardly. They will see God for who he is, and their worship will not just be motions. It will not just be man-made laws. It will be genuine. It will be real. There's a great contrast in verse 24. I know it doesn't apply to any of you, but I was applying it to myself this week. As it talks about the way God is going to change your heart. He's going to change you from fickleness. That word astray is like the word fickleness. He's going to change us from fickleness to having discernment. He's going to change us from murmuring, which is grumbling, to willingness. Again, that doesn't have anything to do with you all, but it meant something to me to see that God knows this kind of heart. He knows a fickle and a grumbling heart, and he knows how to change it. And he will change it. And when he does, it brings about something amazing. How is God going to turn the world upside down? Well, in short, he's going to bring revival to his people. He's going to bring revival to his church. He is going to show himself to us, and he's going to give us eyes to see. He's going to give us those eyes of faith so that we can begin to understand life and reality properly. Now, for our part, we have to submit to God. We have to acknowledge him. We have to seek to know him better. We have to recognize his sovereignty even when we don't understand it. We have to submit to his sovereignty even when we don't like it. Many times we don't know what God's purposes are. But we need to know that it is his purpose which is at work in the world. This only happens in us by a work of God. And so this can only happen if we pray. We must ask for eyes and ears. We must ask God to drive away the fickleness, the grumbling, and the faithlessness. Those things can overtake us. And don't be fooled. They can overtake us in times of plenty, just as they can in times of want. They can overtake us in times of joy, just as they can in times of sorrow. The one thing we need, the one thing we should want, is the one thing God has promised to do, and that is to turn the world upside down, to fill it with true worshipers of him, to reinstate his justice in this world. And this makes it very simple for us, which I don't know about you, but I appreciate. It means the only thing we need to ask for, the only thing we really need to seek, is that God would make himself known to us more and more. And Isaiah promises, indeed God himself promises, that this is what he will do. That if we pray, that if we seek him, he will show himself to us, and then we, like his people thousands of years ago, may sanctify the name of the God of Israel and may stand in awe at the God of our salvation, who not only is able to turn the siege armies away from his city, but is able to turn the hearts of a fickle and grumbling and wayward people toward him in love and worship. May he do this in us.